Hello, are you on the spectrum? Do you know someone who is on the autism spectrum? Well, look no further than today's guest, Dr. Stephanie Holmes, where we're going to be asking questions about the generation gap between parent and child. We'll also be getting questions answered about myself, because today's episode is a little different. She'll be asking me questions as well. So sit back, relax, and grab your favorite beverage, and I'll catch you on the other side. See you there. Hello, and welcome to Inside the Asperger Studios Presents Stories. Today, I'm joined with Dr. Stephanie Holmes, counselor to families on autism and marriage. Welcome to the show, Dr. Stephanie.
Thank you for inviting me, Reed.
Not a problem. I want to start off the show by talking about how do you deal with families who won't recognize that their son or daughter's not on the spectrum and just right up, say you're lazy or unmotivated to do any kind of work or anything.
Right. So I do come across that often, sadly. Sometimes it might be the, you know, why do we need labels? You know, why do we have to have any kind of identification or diagnostic process? And I explain, well, if we're going to get any kind of services at school or after school, you can't just say, I think my child's a little bit on the spectrum. You really have to have an official diagnosis for a 504 or IEP or ADA accommodations in the workforce. And I do sadly hear those who might be a little more old school that discipline is the answer. They may see the autism, instead of being a neurological difference, as just simply behavioral. It's a lack of respect. It's a lack of self-control, and may try old school methods, which are not effective at all in helping people on the spectrum. So I do encounter that a lot. And I think off air, we were talking about that. I do see a correlation if a parent, especially dad, is on the autism spectrum, but hasn't realized it about himself, there tends to be a greater denial that a child is on the spectrum because it might mean some self-reflection.
All right. Now, what about somebody who's on the spectrum, but who denies the term disability? I mean, how do you deal with something like that? Because it is a disability, but yet they won't acknowledge it because they just don't like that word.
Well, I think there's a lot of difference in the autism community about that word disability. Some might want to say like a different ability or a difference. And then some would say, yes, it definitely is a disability. So I think it could be different from person to person on whether or not being on the spectrum rises toward being on a disability wherein you might need accommodations. Because I think for some of those who might have been previously diagnosed as Asperger's or HFA, who are maybe in high positions in a job, wouldn't necessarily see that anything in their life has been negatively impacted by being on the spectrum, except for maybe their spousal relationship. That tends to be a big place that there might be some skill issues. But I think there's a little bit of debate in the community about whether or not it's seen as a disability. And then when I'm asked my opinion, I say, well, here's the thing. The way that our system works is if a person wants an ADA accommodation or a 504 or an IEP, it's under the disability category. You know, so in order to get the rights that are your rights, your civil rights, your educational rights, your employment rights, if it doesn't qualify under the term disability, people don't have to accommodate simply someone's difference or different ability. So it does serve a purpose. In a perfect world, it would be great if schools and employers just did what was necessary to help all people. But sadly, that's not the world we live in. So I think for those who might be more on autism level 2 or 3, I think there might be a higher aspect of disability where they might need to access services. But I think finding that for autism level 1, those individuals might struggle a little bit with being referred to as disabled.
All right. Now, have you come across anybody who just refuses to use the word Asperger's?
Yes. So that's also a big debate in the community. And I am of the mindset that a person's label or identification is theirs. So if someone comes to me and they say, I want to be referred to as Asperger's or Aspie, I'm going to refer to them as Asperger's or Aspie because that's the identification that they've taken on that means something to them. If someone says, I want to be referred to as autistic or I want to be referred to as neurodiverse, I will do my best to respect, you know, whatever identification label. Now, some of the stuff with Asperger's has to do with the debate about who Asperger's is or was. There are those of the camp who say he was doing a great thing by his research on high-functioning kids with autism. And then there are those who feel he is associated with the Nazi party and do not want his name associated with autism. So I kind of hear back and forth within the community. There seem to be very strong opinions inside the autism community. But when someone is coming to me for counseling, I let them choose what their identification is going to be because I feel like it's their identification.
All right. Now, why don't you tell everyone a little bit about yourself? So they have some idea of your background.
Yes. So I started out in school and wanting to be a lawyer, but ended up changing that to counselor. Although I have used some of those kind of lawyery type skills with special education law, because I advocate fiercely for my students who are in the public school. But So I became a counselor first, and then I married my high school sweetheart, Dan, and we will be married 27 years in December. And our journey through autism and Asperger's began about 2005, 2006, when my oldest daughter was identified, and she prefers to identify as Asperger's, Aspie, or neurodiverse. And kind of in the journey of better understanding her, because back in 2005, 2006, people weren't really talking about autism in girls. And so it was really hard to find her resources because they wanted to misidentify her as bipolar or intermittent explosive disorder or oppositional defiant, despite the fact she really had an official diagnosis as autism. So that kind of started me into the world as we as a family were trying to get help and resources, and there wasn't really that much available. It kind of shifted my focus to kind of traditional counseling to focus on marriage and families and family systems that might have autism, multiple disabilities or special needs as a counselor, because our family systems are different and there's different sibling relationships. There might be navigating various things like the school system or when a person's transitioning ADA. And the average parent doesn't know how to do that, and they feel really lost and overwhelmed. So we decided to use our story and our struggle and our journey to really help other people. And that's how Autism Spectrum Resources for Marriage and Family was born. And then as I continued to do work in the field, my husband was identified as on the spectrum level one. And then we also added ministry and coaching to neurodiverse couples. That is where one person is on the spectrum and one person is not. And then specifically in a niche for faith-based people, because there's a lot of stuff out there for couples who are not faith-based, but really not very much for faith-based couples. So that's kind of how we got to that journey. And I would say with a lot of work, I am happily married in a neurodiverse relationship. And we hope to help others who are neurodiverse, who want to do the work to get there too.
God bless you for all you're doing, first of all.
Well, thank you.
I have experienced that. I mean, I've talked with many people who have that kind of mixed relationship between one off and one on. My very first guest, actually, she has a son and daughter, who both are on the spectrum, and her husband's on the spectrum. Then I talked with a mother who's on the spectrum and her two kids are on the spectrum and her husband isn't. So, yeah, I understand that.
It creates, one of the things that we talk about is that communication is very different. So word usage and more of a literal black and white thinking versus someone who's more intuitive or reads between the lines. Sometimes my people on the spectrum would say, don't read between the lines with me. What I told you is what I told you. Take it at face value. Stop trying to, you know, put things that they feel misunderstood. And then sometimes the neurotypical person is like, he just wants to give short answers. He doesn't really want to converse or really want to talk. And he's like, well, conversation is transactional. And they're like, no, conversation is transformational. It's connecting. So kind of seeing that things come from different perspectives and kind of learning to navigate that gap is part of what counseling and coaching can help a couple do.
I take it you've come across the whole SBC things only black and white, and they don't see that center area.
Yes. And so I would say sometimes, since I am of the Christian community, I feel like I can point this out. Sometimes my people on the spectrum who are also in the Christian community may take some things in scripture too black and white that might not be meant that way. Especially there are some specific verses on marriage in the Bible about headship and submission and authority. And sometimes with that black and white thinking might take that in the wrong direction. So we have to kind of address that. And so that can be a little bit tough in the faith-based community. But that's one thing we have to work through. So I would love to know a little bit more about your history or kind of diagnosis journey. Are you okay with sharing that?
Yeah, I'm very okay with it. I'm a very open book, like I tell all my guests.
All right.
Well,
so I guess for you, when were you identified and how was your acceptance? You said some people struggle with their own identification or label. What was your journey of diagnosis and acceptance like?
That's my story is almost like your daughter's, because when I was going through my whole growth of going through grammar school, high school, there was no such thing as autism. So the state of Illinois didn't recognize Asperger's. We applied twice for SSI and got denied because they didn't recognize autism. It wasn't until my late 20s where I had two family members who both were therapists, and my own primary doctor said, I think he has autism. He's got the signs, he's showing symbols of it. I mean, I was diagnosed early on with just a learning disability. And that's all they knew about me back then, is he had a learning disability. I was put in classes for learning disabled. I was put on, at the time, which was an ADHD medicine. We didn't even know I had that. I was put on Sylert. And then later in life took off of it because of health precautions. And then once my family members had told my mother that I may have autism, it was like a light bulb went off in their head. Now, when I heard this from my parents, it kind of explained my little mannerisms to myself, like why I act the way I do, why I say things, as my mom puts it a lot, one of my biggest issues is my filter. I just say what comes to my head. And it's either got me in trouble or just gotten me talked to. And I can count the number of times my filtering has literally either got my parents upset with me or lost me a friend. But I've learned to grow with it. I've learned that I have to literally be cautious of what I'm talking about, who I'm talking to. And one of my biggest issues is I get over-friendly a lot of times. And my parents think maybe that's kind of hindered me with interviews, is because when I get in an interview, I get too confident sometimes and too comfortable and I talk too much.
Learning that time and space. So that would be a great thing, for an intervention to help with interview skills or practice with skills. So I kind of look at kind of being on the spectrum, meaning, you know, there's a different strength and challenge set that comes with each person. People will sometimes say to me, well, how do people on the spectrum do A, B, or C, or what kind of temperament or personality do people on the spectrum? And I say, well, first of all, let's remember whether you're neurotypical or neurodiverse, you're a unique person. You have a temperament, you have a personality, you have preferences. You could be introverted or extroverted. There's different things that are available to a person if a person had resources early on or resources later. So just kind of remembering the diversity that comes within the community as well. I like to, every time I talk, remind people that prior to the 90s, people really associated intelligence and autism together. And those two things really have no, they're not together at all. So a person, I think while some people debate the whole high functioning and Asperger's, I think the good part of that was to show that people on the autism spectrum who are neurodiverse can have intellectual exceptionalities. Because I think up until that happened, people naturally associated autism with being cognitive impairment or cognitive being behind or learning differences or learning disabled, kind of this concept of Rain Man. And by broadening the understanding of autism, that again, any person can have a cognitive impairment, be average IQ, or be exceptional. And by the way, someone could be autistic and be average IQ, cognitively impaired or learning disabled, or intellectually exceptional. So I think that piece has been really great for the autism community, but I still think there's a lot of people out there who automatically assume there's an intelligence issue with autism. And I think that keeps a lot of adults on the spectrum from maybe identifying themselves publicly because they're afraid of that stigma. What do you think about autism and the stigma still associated with autism?
That's an interesting thing. There is a stigma because people look at autism like either it makes us different than the rest of the world, or it holds us back from the rest of the world because of how we act and how we interact with everyone else. But the stigma is, I mean, there's two sides to that stigma. I mean, there are those who see us in the outside and can just look at us and go, you don't look like you're on the spectrum. You don't act like it. And then there are those who look at us and say, and think we're disgusting people and want nothing to do with us because we act different than the norm. And I feel that stigma is what causes the masking, is because you don't want that kind of feeling from either your coworkers, your friends. So you pretend to be normal. And that's when you come home all burnt out because you've been pretending to be something you're not.
Mm-hmm. And I have heard from either teen clients or young adult clients or even adults in a workplace that once they've, you know, kind of told people or maybe made an accommodation request or maybe are getting some kind of special services at school, that they do feel like people sometimes treat them differently just because they need an accommodation or a modification at work or school, that somehow that makes them a less of a person just simply because they need something to accommodate, you know, and get them to where they need to go. That's kind of what I always tell my clients is, I think whatever goal you want to set, if it's realistic, I think you can get there, but it's going to be a different path and it may take a little bit longer. I might just have to figure out the right team and strategies. But simply because someone's on the spectrum doesn't mean that they have to have a less of life. I think one of my people I interviewed defined hope as having other people engage. So, so if we can increase hope in people and families, if we kind of create a community approach of engagement, of helping whatever person on the spectrum or not reach their potential, that's kind of a thing that drives me, is helping people reach their potential.
I tell you, when I was in college, like for my master's, I was like the only one there with a disability. And then when it came time for my exams, I realized I wasn't the only one in that room with on timing. There were so many kids in there with a disability, not all probably with autism, but it kind of made me feel like I wasn't alone. And I think that's one of the biggest problems with those of us on the spectrum, is it's hard to make friends and it's hard to keep relationships because you need someone who sees past your quirks, your mistakes, and sees you for the person you are.
And that is why so many people are married to people on the spectrum, because I think in that dating process, Dr. Atwood says that usually people on the spectrum end up marrying a nurse, an educator, a special education teacher, a counselor, usually somebody in a helping or ministry field that usually kind of saw that potential, didn't quite know what that impact might be and some of the challenges they might endure in a relationship. But I think that's it is having people in your life, if your friendships, a church or a faith community or a relationship that allows you that time and space to kind of be who you are, because that masking and camouflaging, especially for girls, girls on the spectrum, because we socialize girls different and we have higher expectation on girls to socialize in certain ways. And they tend to be identified later in life, 20s and 30s, kind of after a burnout or something kind of major that's happened, because all this time they've been masking or camouflaging. Because there's definitely a different stigma on girls on the spectrum, because they're just expected to know certain things, social skills that might not be present because of the autism.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I've met many people either through social media or through my own blogging, and it's just eye-opening that the girls get it worse because people just don't assume they're on the spectrum. And it's just mind-boggling that people just assume things and they just don't literally just ask.
Yep. And understanding, you know, there's a saying in the community, right? You meet one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. And I think you have to, and I would even say to clinicians and doctors, school psychologists, because I get really frustrated when I send someone for a full diagnosis and they're like, quote, they don't look autistic, or, oh, they made eye contact for 5 minutes, so they can't have autistic. Oh, they told a joke. They have a sense of humor. They can't be on spectrum. If you're really going to be in the field of diagnosing and assessing people on the spectrum, you really need to widen and broaden your perspective, whether it be on YouTube and looking up different people on the spectrum, all over the spectrum, male and female. There's a great autism conference coming up called Cork, where all the speakers are people on the spectrum. So I think you really, if you're going to really work in the field, you need to broaden your perspective, because autism doesn't have a look. You need to understand that might be different person to person.
Yeah. I mean, one of my guests I had, she's a success coach for autism. She's got two kids who are on the spectrum. She told me a very interesting story. It was a brother and sister, and they were out at a camp, and some kids came up to him and told him, you don't look like you're at the spectrum. And it just drove him nuts that they wouldn't acknowledge this. And he went to his sister, and his sister came to his rescue, and because he was crying, and she's like, and he told him this, heard this, and he's like, listen, they don't see you on your other side. They don't know you're taking medication. They don't know what kind of person you are. All they assume is what they see. And I think that's the problem with society, is they only assume what they see and they don't see the other side.
And I think that's a good place to kind of mention ableism, because my daughter in a YouTube that she did talked about, you know, when people think they're complimenting by say, oh, you hide your autism so well, or I would have never guessed you were autistic because you're so normal looking. She said, what you don't understand that you're saying is that, quote, being normal is the only way to be, and that you're encouraging me to mask more and camouflage more. That's really not it's really not a compliment. It's kind of a backhanded compliment, and that, you know, being careful in what we say, you know, even when we are meeting with someone, because that ableistic thinking is that being neurotypical or non-disabled is the only way to be. And, you know, taking into perspective neurodiversity and other persons' differences, delays, disabilities, that we've got to get out of that ableist mindset that there's only one right way to be as a person and how you experience your personhood.
Yeah, I mean, autism is hard. I mean, we almost get the short end of the stick a lot of time in society because we look normal. It's what a lot of us would call, and you probably hear it a lot, the invisible disability. And that's why we get it on the hard end, because people don't see it. It's not like Downs or retardation. And also it's got that stigma of people associate one with the other, and they use that R word that we hate. Or it's, oh, you must be really incredibly smart. You must be like Rain Man. And there's so many things that people get wrong that it kind of puts a damper on us.
It could be a hard stereotype, like for some of my individuals who were diagnosed with Asperger's or high functioning autism back in the day. The stigmatism from the school was like, oh, well, if you have Asperger's or HFA, you don't need any accommodations because you're like super intelligent. But not all people who are high functioning or Asperger's necessarily have exceptional IQ. And then the other end of the spectrum of you're cognitively impaired because you have autism. So mm-hmm. there's like this overly negative or almost overly positive, depending on the Asperger's piece, that I guess when people make those stereotypes kind of judgments, you're not really taking into consideration what still does that individual need to be successful. And my daughter, whose official diagnosis was Asperger syndrome, had like 150 something IQ, but she still needed supports and accommodations in school, mainly for anxiety. I had a hard time that the principals, the people on the IEP team, they would say, well, she doesn't need extra time and quizzes because of her intelligence. I was like, you don't understand. Once you start the clock, her anxiety shuts her brain down. So if you would either not time her or let her know she has extra time, she probably is still going to finish first in the class. But it's the knowing you're being timed that sometimes can shut down her ability. So do you really want to know her ability and what she can do on this test? Are you more concerned about it fitting within your time standard? If you really want to know what she's capable of, give her the daggum accommodation. So even trying to get those things and getting the educators to understand the accommodations and modifications might be used differently with someone on the spectrum. It is about sometimes the anxiety or the angst or shutting down and trying to help with emotional regulation, because when emotional dysregulation happens, a person can't learn. So there might be sensory things going on in the classroom. Let's take that into accommodation. There might be that preferential seating. Where does this person need to sit that they feel comfortable, or if they're an escape risk, maybe not sitting by a door, but maybe if they struggle getting distracted looking at the lawnmower outside the window, maybe we don't want them by a window. So sometimes teachers especially get really caught up in it not being fair. Yeah. And so I say fair is a four-letter word.
I mean,
and it's not a good one. No. Because it's really not fair. This person has differences, delays, and disability either. So we need to, you know, even the playing ground here to make sure this person has what they need to get the education that they need.
I mean, I experienced that myself when I was going for my master's. I went to a teacher because I went through a disability thing. And I had a disability advisor and everything. And because of that, I was given access to teachers to say, I can go to them and ask for a little bit more help. But I got to run around because I kept going to him and he kept telling me the same thing. If I help you, then I got to help everyone else. And I kept telling him, but it's part of my disability contract with you guys that I get a little bit more extra help. I had literally ask him over and over and over until he decided to say, okay, I come to my office at this time, we'll sit down and I'll help you.
Sometimes people confuse fair and equal. So there might not be always equal treatment. If somebody else needs more resources and help, then it actually is fair to give that resources and help needed versus trying to make everything equal all the time. Because sometimes equal doesn't always mean fair. And I think that's sometimes really hard. I find this especially for, we'll call it old school educators, maybe even professors, that somehow by giving a modification or accommodation, you are diluting the person's education in some way, or somehow like giving them a pass on things. And that's not what's being asked when there's accommodations and modifications. It's what are the things that this person needs to get them to the same place, whether it's a master's degree, college, or high school education, middle school. What is it this person needs? And if we take an individualized approach versus the mass approach, that's how we help that person the best. And so there are people who are just more inclined to want to do that. And then there are people who are like, nope, this person's just lazy, or they're just not working hard enough, or they just procrastinated. And I think it's much easier when you call it a character trait or a behavior trait, because then that means you as an educator don't have to do anything about it, or you as a parent don't have to do anything about it. Because if I make it just about you and your lack of self-control and discipline, then that kind of absolves me of any responsibility or help. But if I really look at autism as a difference or a disability or a delay, then that means maybe I'm on the hook and I need to help and do something a little bit different. So that might sometimes be, back to our original question, that might sometimes be part of the denial as well, I think.
I've taken it, you've dealt with schooling and them recognizing somebody, either one of your, either your daughter or one of your clients, they just don't see it as being on the spectrum. How do you deal with that? I mean, especially with schools and not recognizing that your child or a client needs help.
I think the thing that frustrates me the most is when the school, a college, or employment, because how it works to get a 504 and IEP is you have to prove to the school that the autism somehow is impacting academic success. Now, a person could be having A's and B's, and so that still doesn't really take into consideration the amount of effort. Like if that person is having to take 8 to 10 hours to get their homework done, or having stress, or increasing their anxiety, or their social skill differences, they're being bullied or excluded at school because there's not the social skills that are needed. There's a much bigger concept than just someone's grade on how they're being impacted in the school system. And what a lot of educators don't know is that the federal mandates under the IDEA actually say that we are supposed to do not only things that help the person academically, we're supposed to help socially, and the IEP should look into transition after school and help with transition for that young adult beyond the high school. So usually many IEPs that I have seen, and I studied this for my dissertation research, are often lacking in anything that is emotional regulation or social skills building, peer building, or really helping the person transition after school. It really is like this grade year, what I think the behaviors are, they tend to really be behavior focused. Those behavior intervention plans, really just focusing on, you know, raising your hand or not interrupting, or, you know, not running out of a classroom, which of course these are important safety issues. But sometimes the IEPs focus so much on the BIP, they're really not focused on what are the other things that's contributing to this person being just anxious in school. Because like I said, if your fight or flight system is on and you are anxious, you are not learning. You are strategizing on how to get out the door, counting down to when it's time to get to the next class or get away from this teacher. You're not learning if you're anxious. So I think there's a lack of understanding that with many people, not all, on the spectrum, anxiety in itself can be debilitating. And so working on things like peer interactions, interview skills, making a phone call, driving. These are all things we don't really think about, but these are things that are going to impact independent skills later in life. And so some of those basic things aren't even addressed in high school. So for the educators listening, they want to also make it OHI a lot on the IEP. They really struggle with putting autism on an IEP. They usually want to make it behavior impairment or OHI for other health impairment. And I think when you stop looking at a person that they're on the spectrum and really labeling the situation what it is, I think you're not taking into perspective the full person, and you're so focused on what are the negative impacts or how badly is this person failing versus what can we do to optimize or maximize this person to help them get what they need before they graduate. And then let's also be proactive in thinking, what does this person need to really transition, you know, outside? They might need additional help with, how do I plan for the SAT or ACT? How do I sign up for that? How do I do, like I said, an interview, a job interview? Maybe I don't want to go to college. I want to go to the working world. These things are just lacking in IEP and transition. And I think the schools could do a better job.
Yeah. Now, have you dealt with any of your clients who deal with low self-esteem?
I didn't hear that last word. That deal with what?
Low self-esteem.
A lot. So especially if those that I've worked with, if they've had very negative experiences in middle school and high school, church youth groups, children's church ministry, if they have had either exclusion, which maybe at school or in church, people are kind of nice to them, to their face. I'm like, oh, hi, nice to see you today. But they really don't invite them to birthday parties, don't invite them to community events, or, you know, text them or check in. You know, that's really a form of exclusion. And then there's outright bullying. You know, there's the mean girls, and there's physical bullying that happens. So I think what a lot of kids that I work with experience, and my daughter experienced this too, is sometimes in elementary school, elementary kids are a little more forgiving and a little more like, I'll be your friend. And one thing that works to an advantage of someone on the spectrum is usually they have the coolest toys. So if they're into dinosaurs or My Little Ponies or whatever, they've got one of the best collections of those toys. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of works to their advantage and play dates, so to speak, if they have them. But where the thing really starts to change is in middle school, people finding these groups and then exclusion based on, you have to fit into a certain group. And if I associate with you and you're not cool, then I could be bullied because I'm associated with you. And my daughter experienced that, like friends who were friends in elementary school, that when it was middle school and high school, it's like, if I hang out with you, my popularity status is going to change. So like, we got to break up this friendship because I don't want to be associated with you. That's really hurtful. And that's very harmful. I even had in one situation, the girl's parents encouraged that. They told the girl to visibly kind of break off the friendship in a very embarrassing way to my daughter, so that everyone knew they were no longer best friends, so that she could climb up the popularity pole. And they had no problem telling that to me, to my face. The mom said, you know how things are. Your daughter's not popular, and my daughter wants to be popular. If you really cared about my daughter, you would see her best interest here. And it's not really anything personal. It's just that, you know, we're just not going to recognize this friendship anymore. And my face was like, are you kidding me? You're saying that that's a normal thing to say. You are teaching your daughter to socially exclude someone with a difference or a disability. You are teaching her that her own popularity is more important than how you treat a human being. How can you live with yourself saying something like that? That is really awful. But had no qualms about it at all. Felt really justified that, you know, that's just how kids are, Stephanie. So I'm not going to put my daughter in the position of having to take up for your daughter kind of a situation. So a lot of my kids on the spectrum have experienced something like that in middle school or high school. And then they think, okay, well, maybe if I get to college, you know, I can kind of start over. But you're kind of starting with a deficit of self-esteem and self-worth. There's a lot of things that have said, hey, if I put myself out there, I might be rejected. And so there's a myth out there that people on the spectrum want to be alone or isolate. And I say, no. Being alone in isolation is usually a result of how people have treated them. That means to me, they've tried to have friendships, they tried to put themselves out there, and they've been rejected. And so like any human being, if you get rejected and you put yourself out there and no one's accepting you, isolation or being alone is a self-protection mechanism. It's not always somebody's first choice. Really super introverted people, that might be perfectly fine, but that's really not, it's really a self-esteem, self-worth issue. And so then in college, if you have that same repetition of that happening or a bad roommate situation, it certainly compounds that. And then self-worth can compound anxiety, and then anxiety can impact confidence. And now you have a difficult time getting that person to transition into the world of work because there's a social landmine out there that might have the skills and the intelligence to do the job, but that social skills and confidence and peer rejection is a real thing that has to be dealt with.
Yeah, I've dealt
May
with
I
that.
May I ask if you have experienced that?
Yes, I have experienced that going through high school a lot. I really didn't have many friends. I felt isolated. I almost felt like I had to be somebody I wasn't, which was hard on me because I'd come home being miserable. Like, I have no friends. I mean, I graduated high school with almost one or two friends, and that was it. College was, like you said, I almost had to start over. But for me, my bachelor's was online. So for me to make friends online in school was hard. Because I was different. I still had trouble differentiating right from wrong, what things to say and such. So I kind of got ostracized by my group pairs and stuff. And I had to do stuff on my own. But when it came time for my master's, where I had to make friends all on my own, because I was in a college atmosphere, I found it best was when I was in a society that I enjoyed and others enjoyed. And that's where my group of friends stayed. But what hurt me was the minute I graduated, a majority of those friends stopped talking to me. Only two or three of them still talk to me to this day. And it's like, I don't get it. You talk to me for a whole entire year through society meetings and everything, and we did stuff together. And then the minute I graduate, it's like you cut ties with me. And that hurt.
And I think while I do think that people on the spectrum certainly experience that more, I think in society in general, even like if a person goes to a certain church and then they move to another church, they might not have same relationships. And I think that's sad. Or after college, you know, people's life change and it's like, I guess we're so person-centric, right? Like, what's my life? What's my network? And what gets me to my next step? Or, you know, this is my college things, but now I'm in my career. And, you know, so I see that even in the neurotypical population too, that friendships can be very based to the activity or based to the college or the church campus or something like that. And I think that's a shame, but I think that shows us that as we can connect in so many ways online and through technology that as a society, we lack really connecting with people and being involved in people's lives and more beyond the superficial. People think they're more connected than they are, but really when it kind of comes down to it, a lot of people have a lot of superficial relationships. And I think that's sad for neurotypical or neurodiverse populations. But to your point, you know, if a person's been treated differently and a person's been purposely excluded or isolated or bullied, and then to have made a friend and have a relationship, to have that cut off, that can be traumatic for some individuals. And I think in the neurotypical world, when you think, oh, well, I can just make a friend and make a new one tomorrow. I could not have this friendship. And it's like, okay, but that's simple for you. That's easy for you, but that's not how everybody else experiences relationships. So it feels a lot deeper of a cut when you cut off a relationship with someone with any kind of difference, disability or delay, because it's like, wait a minute, that was my person. Where did my person go? Where did my friendship go? But I do tell my clients a lot that kind of finding a set of people who will let you be you is a goldmine. And so maybe that means in high school or college or graduate school or the community, finding like in high schools, if there's robotics club or math club or history club, or my daughter was into Latin and she loved mythology. So she was in the Latin club and now she's a history major. And so she can talk about mythology and history with all people in her group, you know, that like history and mythology. So finding those people who want to talk about the things you want to talk about and finding that activity before or after school or a community. Kind of let's go fishing in a barrel, maybe instead of fishing in the ocean. And that might help with some relationships, I think, too.
Yeah, no, let's get to know you a little bit more. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina. And while I currently live in Atlanta, would consider myself a Carolina girl. I'm still a Carolina girl at heart.
All right. What motivates you, inspires you, and drives you?
I think even since I was younger, people would tell me kind of I had a high sense of social justice or advocacy. I've always kind of been a person for the underdog or equal and fair treatment of people. So I think advocacy and justice and helping people reach their potential, I think that's the most gratifying thing for me.
All right. What's the best compliment you've ever received?
I was thinking about that right before we got on the air. And I think one time, you know, because sometimes people in your community, you know, will give you compliments, whatever. But I got one from a stranger that I kind of appreciated because I think, I guess maybe I was exuding something or giving a vibe that was positive. But I was on a plane and I was on a trip to Central America. And the lady beside me starts kind of opening up her life story to me, not even knowing I was a counselor, just kind of like, started telling me, and she's like, I don't know why I'm telling you this, but you have a confia face. She was Hispanic, and she says confia means trust. There's just something about you that seems trustworthy. And she's like, if you're not a counselor, you should be a counselor. I was like, well, that's kind of what I am. But I guess the fact that she felt I was safe and trustworthy and that she could place a confidence in me, I think that was a really big compliment from a perfect stranger.
That is a perfect compliment, actually. When a stranger gives you a compliment, that tells you something.
Right. That's what I was thinking. So that felt really good to me.
What is your biggest failure and what did you learn from that experience?
So I don't want to give the specifics because I think I would embarrass my daughter. But I think in the beginning, in my own understanding of autism, I made some parenting mistakes and I probably said some things I wish I could take back before I knew, you know, probably parents shouldn't say some of those things anyway. But when I lacked the understanding of autism and Asperger's and I made certain assumptions and we had certain behavior modification things that maybe were not appropriate under the circumstances, I think parenting failure is one of my biggest failures and regret. I wish I would have understood a little bit more. I wish I would have had some more support. And I certainly hate some of the things that happened during those early years before I knew better.
All right. Can you tell me about three influential people in your life and how they impacted you?
That one was tough too. So if I go kind of broad, I think first and foremost, my faith, not just in God or spirituality, but in Jesus Christ, a personal relationship. That's the most transformative relationship in my life. And then a book that I read, and this is going to seem weird that a young girl read this, but it was a book by Corrie Ten Boom, and she was a concentration camp survivor. She survived that. And her books on forgiveness and reading that at a young age, because when you are in the special needs community and you have a special needs child, people are going to hurt and offend you. And so learning to forgive and learning how to not build resentment against ignorant people, that book, when I was a kid, reading that from Corrie Ten Boom's perspective, that was extremely influential, even though I never met her, of course, but her books and watching interviews with her. And then for the third one, that was really hard. I think there's been different people in different parts of my life. So I don't know how to answer that one because there's been maybe people in my faith community or friendships or kind of like a person God put in my life or a specific season that helped in a certain way. So I think that third one's kind of this open spot for how God uses people in your life in different seasons that you're in that has been helpful to me.
All right. What makes you feel inspired or like your best self?
That one's also hard. I think it also, for me, I believe that people have gifts and strengths. And I, from a faith-based perspective, I believe those are given to us by God and we're created in a unique way. And we each have a calling, a plan or a purpose. And I think when what I'm doing is in alignment with my faith and my calling and purpose, I think that's the most fulfilling because I'm kind of a type A strong-willed person. And I feel like I can be successful in a lot of different things just because I'm really stubborn. But when it's really in that calling and purpose and alignment, I think that's the most fulfilling.
All right. Finish the sentence. I'm at my best when...
Ooh, I'm certainly at my best when I am rested and fed. I'm at my worst when my blood sugar is low and I have not had very good sleep. So, and I think my family would be saying, amen, feed the girl and let her sleep.
All right. If you can turn back time and talk to your 18-year-old self, what would you tell her about where you are now in life?
Wow. So for me at 18, it was quite a different experience than other people. So for me at 18, I was engaged to be married. I was in my last year of college because I graduated college at 19. And so I was a very driven type A person. And I definitely thought like every decision or everything is like super important. So I probably would tell her to chill a little bit, that things are going to be okay. And there's going to be a lot of things that are going to come up in your life that you're not going to understand. But the Lord is going to be with you through it. Because I certainly at 18 didn't even have the concept of autism. I mean, my only understanding of autism was the one movie Rain Man. That was it. That was all I had. Mm-hmm. And so that 18-year-old girl did not know what was coming down her journey, but I would definitely tell her to kind of chill out and relax. Not everything is as important as you think it is.
All right. If you can have a billboard with anything on it, what would it be and why?
Gosh. Well, my favorite verse in the Bible is Jeremiah 29:11. And one of the things I tell all of my clients and all of my family's marriages is, in Jeremiah 29:11, it says, like, behold, I know the plans for you, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans for hope and a future. So usually one of my taglines or things that I like to say on my podcast is there's no exclusion clause to Jeremiah 29:11. There's no exclusion clause for hope and a plan for a future. Now, for me, that comes through a relationship with Jesus being part of that. But I think just inspiring others that there is hope and there is a future, because sadly in the autism community, there is a high rate for depression and suicide. And that really breaks my heart because today seems so bad. It's hard to think about tomorrow and there is a future, but there is hope and there is a future.
All right. What do you think the world will look like in 5 years from now?
You know, that's really tough. I don't even know if I can go there, but I'll say the world is very divided on many issues right now. And I don't think that's going to get better in 5 years, sadly.
All right. What was your favorite subject in school?
I really love history the most. In fact, when I was in college, I was actually a pre-law major with a history concentration. So I really loved American history and American government, anything in that area. So I weirdly have a psychology major with a history minor, because when I changed, I had already done all those history classes.
All right. Would you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
I've actually found out that I'm an ambivert. So I, as a younger person, I was probably way more extroverted. And then there were kind of times I think I kind of adapted to having an introverted husband and an introverted daughter that I maybe kind of became a little bit more introverted. But I think I'm actually more kind of adaptable to the situation, sometimes a little bit more extroverted, sometimes a little bit more introverted. So I think that's called ambivert now. So I think I'd fall in that category.
All right. If you could be remembered for one thing, what would it be and why?
Well, I first of all would hope that people would see a reflection of my faith in Jesus, number one. But I hope the way that that would be seen is that if I had to leave a legacy, she helped people, she believed people, she treated people the way Jesus would want them treated. The golden rule is really important, treat others the way you want to be treated. So I hope that would be a legacy or what people would remember me for, that not just that I'm a Christian, because a lot of people call themselves Christian that don't act very Christ-like. Mm-hmm. I would like to be a Christian that is known to be more Christ-like.
And now, why did you want to start your podcast?
So I had been doing as an interim host. We're both on the Mental Health News Radio platform. And I had been asked to be an interim host for Converge Autism Radio, which is another fabulous autism platform. But as wonderful as that experience was, because it was more of a secular platform, I felt like my faith, or maybe addressing things of faith, I could say faith and house of worship on that podcast. But I really felt like there are so many things out there. There are so many professionals out there that work with children on the spectrum and work with people who are not faith-based. I really wanted to do neurodiverse Christian couples to recognize that this is a growing population of marriage. If children are 1 in 54, you have to kind of think that probably adults are 1 in 54, which means marriages could be 1 in 54. So the focus on adults and adult issues and job issues and relationship issues for adults on the spectrum, because I don't think there's enough resources and research out there. And then secondly, in the faith community, like I said, especially ministers, Christian counselors, biblical counselors, chaplains may not really understand the nuances that come with a faith-based neurodiverse couple. And so I really wanted to speak to, that sounds like a really small niche, but there are a lot of people, there are so many Facebook groups out there called NT Wives and Asperger Husbands, or like, there are a lot out there. It's a growing niche that people don't understand. And if you approach that couple as if they're both neurotypical, you could do harm to one or both parties through counseling or through ministry or whatever. So that's really the driving force, is I want to educate and train and help people in the ministry and helping field. But I also want couples to know you're not alone out there. I'm in a neurodiverse marriage. There are other people listening to this that are in neurodiverse marriage. And because sometimes we interview people or other professionals and kind of in this, and I want them to know you're not alone. And this isn't like a weird thing to be. This is a growing niche in the population. So that's another little tagline to say is there's hope for the future and you're not alone in your journey.
All right. Now we come to this part of the show where I ask you the famous questions. What is your favorite word?
Oh, I was thinking about that. And I don't think I have a favorite word. I certainly have a least favorite word, but I don't think I have a favorite word.
All right. What is your least favorite word?
Okay, it's weird, but the word moist. I don't like the word moist. I don't like the way it sounds. I don't like what it implicates.
Okay. What turns you on creatively, spiritually, and emotionally?
Wow, that's a hard one too. I think we've been in a very difficult situation this past almost year and a half. The short part of the story is a tree fell on our house and we were displaced from our home, and we've moved all over the metro Atlanta area. I think we're up to like 8 or 9 moves. And it's really disrupted community. It's really disrupted faith community. It's disrupted family and community. And so I think I've really missed these past, because sometimes when the insurance company tells you you're evicted and you have to move, you're using your weekend, which would have been your fun time, to move up, pack up, and, you know, get to the next place. And I think really realizing how much community is important, that collaboration is done in community, growth is done in community, whether it's your church community or the autism community or Bible study small group community, that has been lacking, no fault of any person. But I think community and collaboration is where I get creativity.
All right. What turns you off?
What turns me off? People with limited perspectives, and people who, I'm really high on justice. So injustice and people being treated incorrectly or harmed, that turns me off. It also makes me a very unhappy, angry individual when I see that happening. That usually motivates me to act as well.
All right. What is your favorite cuss word?
Think as a pastor, I'm supposed to have one. So I might have to pass on that one, but certainly do not use the Lord's name in vain.
All right. What sound or noise do you love?
One thing over this kind of COVID stuff, getting outside more, I really do like the sound of rivers or waterfalls or kind of moving water, not necessarily rain, but moving water. I think I like that's very calming.
What sound or noise do you hate?
I hate things that are sudden and loud, especially if someone's trying to sneak up on me and make that sudden loud noise just because I have a really exaggerated startle response and people like to see me react. I don't like that too much.
Right. What is your favorite color?
Purple, definitely. Ever since I was a little girl, purple, purple, purple.
What is your least favorite color?
Orange. Sorry for all you orange lovers. I don't like it.
Right. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
It's interesting, but you know, sometimes the creative side of me, another skill set that I have is organization. And I love, like, my girls had really great birthday parties. Or my friends usually would ask me to throw the baby shower or the wedding shower, or let's, you know, plan a trip. So if I wasn't in the field that I was, I think events and planning, I think that's pretty fun.
All right. What profession would you not like to do?
Based on who I am and my high sense of justice, I could not work around perpetrators, especially sex offenders and child offenders. I definitely could not work with that population. Everyone can be redeemed, but I think that would be a really hard population for me to work with.
If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
I think, you know, in scripture, it talks about what we want to hear is, well done, thy good and faithful servant. So I want to know that my life mattered and that God is pleased with how I live my life, and that it was done in a way that, again, represented Christ, not just being a Christian and going to church and being religious, but actually being a follower of Christ and doer of Christ's will on earth. That's what I would like to hear.
And when you arrive at heaven, who would you like to meet?
Okay, so the standard answer has to be Jesus, but I'll go deeper than that because every person wants to meet Jesus. But somebody I was always fascinated with in the Old Testament, her name is Deborah, and she was one of the a female judge who was in leadership. So I like to remind people there were females in leadership in the Old Testament. But I would really love to know from her perspective, because she was strong-willed and kind of a big personality, it sounds like, and she was in an ancient culture and leading men. I would really love to know more about that from her perspective.
And what books would you recommend my audience read?
Oh, so many good things. One that I think the most recognized author that I think has good stuff out there is Tony Atwood. I mean, he's got so many. But if you're faith-based, I want to tell you about those two. So Ron Sanderson and Lamar Hardwick are both individuals on the spectrum, and they have research on raising children in the faith, how church could be more inclusive. They've interviewed people on the spectrum and their life journeys. And so definitely those. And then if you're interested in kind of our faith journey, I have a book out there too, Confessions of a Christian Counselor. So you could always get that too.
And finally, where can people find you on the web?
You can find me at two places. So www.homesasr.com. That is the home for autism spectrum resources for marriage and family. And so that's kind of where the coaching and counseling practice is. And we're working on getting some free resources on there, as well as some classes and courses for parents and educators. And then our new endeavor is ChristianNeurodiverseMarriage.com. And that is specifically for neurodiverse Christian couples, which you can link to our podcast there as well. But it's also more of a training organization. We want to train counselors, chaplains, coaches, ministers, anyone who would be working with marriage. We want to train them on the nuances of a neurodiverse Christian couple. And so that is more of the training institute. So those are the two places you could find me on the internet.
And that's it. Thank you so much, Dr. Stephanie, for coming on my show.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Reed. It's been a great to talk to you and get to know you a little bit better.
Yeah. Talk to you soon.
Thanks.
It's a good day. It's a good life. But you're walking around. so don't go waste it. Stop a second, cause I know you can taste it. Tell me what you wanna do, and then we're gonna make.